Session number 9253, reel 34.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, reel 34. You say you caught the flu epidemic. Were the symptoms worse than what we call flu now in 1986? Was it very much worse?
Well, I don't know what flu is today, but to me, in those days, in 1918, couldn't be any worse, because I went to bed normally, but in the morning, I had been struck down by this flu, and that's how it struck people. In fact, all the hospitals were full, and tents were erected in all the hospital grounds in and about York. And I was some 10 days or 12 days in this tent. And
what,
then I went.
What were the symptoms, basically?
Well, you felt drained of everything, sweated, and weak. Sense of weakness.
What treatment did they give you during this 10 days?
Nothing. Well, I don't know what treatment they gave us. We took medicine and lie in the open air and that, fresh air. I don't know if it was any special treatment. I don't know.
Did your wife get it?
No. She visited me every day and she never got it. No, visited every day. And then I reported back to the PT Centre at York.
What were you taught there? What was you say you were on these courses. What were you taught on the PT courses?
Well, on a PT course, it's a physical training course. I did 3 weeks and I did 6 weeks. Went to York for 6 weeks. Didn't finish it. And then I went back and did another 6 weeks. And there, you are trained on physical training from 7 in the morning till 5 at night in the afternoon. And you are doing physical training the whole time.
What sort of things?
Well, the normal things of those days. You would go out on it at 7 in the morning. The instructors wore a red and black jersey that was distinguished them from any other NCOs. Every instructor on the physical training staff was a sergeant. And when you spoke to an instructor, and anybody on a training course spoke to an instructor, he stood to attention the whole time, didn't address him as sir, because he was a non-commissioned officer, but he was very respectful to that NCO. You know, NCO is non-commissioned officer. And you did arms bend and knees bend and all that for an hour in the morning, then breakfast, then after breakfast you did all kinds of other things. Among them, bayonet fighting. We did an hour training on bayonet fighting every morning on that course at York. I remember at York, bayonet fighting, you had to learn the stance with your rifle, the Lee Enfield, with its bayonet, and the thrust in, out, and then back on guard. So that in, out, on guard was a common phrase when you were doing bayonet fighting. In, out, on guard. And that's how we trained. We trained that like that in the standing position, of course. And then we trained in an advancing position, running at sandbags filled full of straw and hung up like a gallows. And the sandbag, not a big one, a sack. We ran forward, a and dabbed all rifled bayonet into the sand, into the sack, which was filled full of straw, painted as a German soldier, of course, and we had to try and hit him on the left breast all the time. Didn't have any head, it was just a sack and a German on it, you see.
Were you taught how to teach other people as well, or were you just taught
not at York. I was under course training. Well, I must have got good marks, because after I went back after the course finished, the end of 6 weeks, I went back to Northumberland, Alnwick, and from there I was sent down to Aldershot. Now, Aldershot is the headquarters of the Physical Training Corps of it's the Corps of Physical Training headquarters in Aldershot. And I was placed on the staff there. I must have got very good marks at that York school, because I was immediately given a red and black jersey. I was a sergeant. You had to be a sergeant before you could wear one of those. And there I remained till the end of the war.
When did you get there, roughly?
In the summer of 1918. So I was there several months in Aldershot when the war finished.
Were you in married quarters at Aldershot, or was your wife with you?
No, she wasn't there.
Can you tell me about your work as a physical training instructor then? What you did?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, it was impressed upon us that the physical training corps was the elite of the British Army, was responsible for the discipline of the British Army, and at all times we instructors who were on the physical training corps had to maintain that position. Wherever we went, we had to march in a smart, soldier-like manner. If we stopped, we stood to attention. We had to insist when any soldier spoke to us that they addressed us as an NCO sergeant. They had to stand to attention while they were talking to us. We had to insist on discipline at all times. Now, in the morning, there would be an hour training before breakfast, and soldiers from all over the British Isles, came to Aldershot to be trained as physical training instructors. And it was our job, being on the staff of the Corps, to train these men. They did 8 weeks of it with us. Everyone who came to Aldershot did 8 weeks training. And at the end of that, they were graded into first, second, and third type of instructors. They would go back to their own regiments, wherever they were in the British Isles, in the British Army, rather, and were responsible for the physical training of their regiment or battalion. November the 11th arrived.
And before we get to that, how did you actually go about training a physical training instructor? What methods did you use to make them competent?
Well, they did just the same training that we had done, that we had got in all different training courses on physical training.
They weren't given any special instructions?
Well, they were specially selected by their regiment. They were specially selected by their regiment as someone who could be made into an instructor, So they were already selected before they came to us. Then when they came to us, at the end of our 8 weeks course, we instructors, we had to grade all the different men, either first, second or third, I remember, as regards their ability to be an instructor and how proficient they were in all the different aspects of physical training.
Would they practice in front of a squad?
Oh yes, we had squads. And you had 16 men, and you're with them for 8 weeks. The whole of the 8 weeks they were there, they were your men. So you got to know them intimately, and they got to know you, you see.
Would the men have a go at drilling the squad, though, so they get used to giving commands?
Oh yes, the last few days, the last week or so, they would be out and given, they would take the squad over from us in their turn. Oh yes, that's part of the training. So you, apart from, first of all, getting to know all the different aspects of the physical training and being at fighting, don't forget, and being at fighting, you had then to be able to impart that to a squad in their own regiment.
You see, and
that's what we instructors had to judge them on. I mean, a fella could be physically fit himself and, you know, tip-top condition and so on, but if he wasn't able to impart that to his regiment, well, it's no use. So I was more than that, just physical fitness in it, you see. It was the ability to impart that to your regiment.
You say you got to know the trainees quite well, the soldiers there.
Well, it is.
What sort of relationship did you have with them?
Very strict, you know. We were on the staff of the physical training staff of the British Army. We were responsible for, yes.
If you were going across the square,
and you passed somebody, he would turn his head that way, you know, salute. Didn't salute you, but turn his head, you know, turn his head that way smartly, and you could see them. You could see the fellas if they saw us. Well, very distinguished, of course, with red and black jerseys. You'd see them smarten themselves up if they saw any red and black jersey, you know.
So you'd be respected rather than popular?
Oh, yes, I suppose so. Oh, yes, we had a job to do. Oh, I mean, I expect they thought that we were hard, and so we were. But you had to be hard to be able to put it across to the fellas. Oh, yes. Anybody that wasn't hard and able to put into their voice an order which you expected to be obeyed. That was the way you had to look on it, you know. Yes.
What happened then on Armistice Day? You were about to tell me earlier.
Oh, well, on Armistice Day, November the 11th, 1918, we paraded as usual. No mention of Armistice Day to us. We parade as usual at 7 in the morning, and then breakfast time came. And by breakfast time, the bells began to ring, church bells ringing, sirens were blowing, bugles were blowing, there was bands marching in the town of Aldershot, cheering and yelling, and railway engines hooting. And the place was in uproar soon after breakfast time, but not in the barracks of the physical training centre. The physical training centre at Aldershot carried on that day, Armistice Day 1918, as if nothing had happened. We did all we had to do. We stopped for dinner. We stopped in the morning for a 10 minutes blow, and then we stopped for dinner, and we went on till 5 o'clock. And in the town, all this noise and narration And at 11 o'clock, of course, in the morning, you know, the town outside those barracks was alive in Aldershot. Because Aldershot has always been noted as the centre of the British Army. Aldershot, the town of Aldershot, has always been recognised as the headquarters of many of the regiments of the British Army. It still is the headquarters of the British Army Corps of Physical Training.
When did you first realise that there'd been an armistice? When were you told?
Oh, well, I mean, newspapers were full of it coming. Oh, no. Quite a few days before.
What was your own reaction then to the armistice? What did you think?
Well, actually, you see, we had our job to do. And at 5 o'clock when we finished, you know, when we finished with your squad, you weren't finished, you know, because you had all your written material to write up every night about each member of your squad. So you were kept going. Now then at night, in the barracks at Aldershot of the Physical Training Corps, the Physical Training Corps had gathered together all the prominent boxers of the day, all the prominent cricketers of the day, all the prominent footballers of the day, and anyone with any country-wise, you know, in sport of any kind, were all gathered together at Aldershot. And they were placed on the staff, as we were, but they didn't have anything to do with the training. But they were there to ensure that after the war was finished, they were still there. See, they weren't. See, there was the two brother cricketers there at the time. Who would they be? I forget. Two very prominent, played for England, two cricketers. Well, they were there at the end of the war, available for cricket. But if they had been stayed where they were in their home county, they would have been called up. Now, the boxers at night, they give entertainment to all we, because we didn't get very much liberty, you know. Now that the fellas on the training courses who came from all over the British Isles, no way of the staff. And my wife wasn't there because our billets were inside the barracks. And I used to be watching the boxing every night. And then, of course, cricketers, footballers, and all those, they were supposed to do a certain amount of training during the day, but they had to exhibit themselves on an evening.
Was there a special exhibition or...
No, just ordinary training exercises.
No, I mean, was there a special do on Armistice Night?
Oh, no. At 5 o'clock, we were finished. Well, I finished. Went home, went back to my training centre. It collapsed, everything collapsed. No, at 5 o'clock, you never stopped for tea. And you got your travel permit and away you went back to your regiment. That's what I did, and I expect everybody else did as well.
So you went immediately back to your regiment after Armistice?
In Northumberland, oh yes, straight up.
Yes. So what happened then prior to your demobilisation?
Oh, we spent a trying time because we spent about, I don't know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, just standing about waiting on
your
name.
Was this
Danik, waiting on your name being called out. Because you couldn't go home, you see. You had to be there. You had to be there. And meal times broke the day up for you. That was Marquise and Annick, I remember, where we used to go and feed. But the war was finished as far as we were concerned, and for everybody else, you see.
Did you ever think of staying in the army, you know, as a physical training instructor?
Not me. No, I wanted to get back to my Boy Scouts.
What exactly happened when you were demobilised then? It was in December, was it?
November the 11th.
I'll
be home by December, surely. I'll be home, because, I mean, we only spent a fortnight or 3 weeks standing about the Danik, and then went back home.
So when were you demobilised?
Well, at the end of the year, somewhere about the end of the year.
What exactly happened when you were demobilised?
Well, nothing. You were just given your travel permit, and that was all. You're finished. Didn't make any spectacular parade or anything like that. No, nothing like that. Well, the officers were the same as us. The war was over for them. No, we just got our travel permit to go home. So.
When you got home, did you have any difficulty getting a job back down the mine?
Oh, no. Welcomed you. Everybody just went back. And I was still... You see, when I got back, they were still wanting pony drivers, putters, you know. They were still in need of the putters, young fellas. I'll be about 23. Well, I did over a year when I first went back to pony driving, putting. And I did very well from money's point of view, because I was big and strong, physically fit, and down the pit in putting. You see, I've talked about the endless ropes, bringing the empty tubs in and taking the full tubs out. And then when you get to the siding nearest the working place, the younger boys, just after leaving school, they brought in the empty tubs into another siding closer to the working place. And from there, we were the drivers, but we called ourselves putters.
One thing that comes to mind is, you say you had no trouble getting a job, but you say there was no shortage of work of miners down the mine while the war was on.
No.
Now, at the end of the war, when all the people who joined up came back,
There wasn't that many.
So it didn't make it, there was no...
No appreciable. I mean, you take the territorials. Well, when we pulled up from Class W, it was only 70-odd of us. For the whole of the 7th Northumberland Fusiliers, you know. And those 8 companies, those 72 that I had, territorials, some would go perhaps to Alnwick, some to Morpeth, some to Amble, some to Berwick-on-Tweed. I mean...
So you were easily fitted back in?
Oh, everybody fitted in very well.
How had the war affected you as a person, do you think? Did it make a difference to the way you looked at things? Had it done anything for you? Or had it...
Well, it made me think more of myself as a man. That's what you mean. But, I mean, I don't think there's much more than that, really. No, and I was growing up and I was married, you see, then. So I had responsibilities. And also in scouting, you see, I had more responsibilities, because in scouting I was the district commissioner at once, and I came back for the whole of that Ashenden and Newbiggin district. That gave me certain amount of extra work and interests.
I believe you visited Belgium in charge of some scouts in 1920. Could you tell me a little about your visit to the battlefield and what you saw?
Yes, well, as I said, I was back in scouting at home. So in 1920, after the war, I took 18 Rover scouts and I booked through a travel bureau and stayed in a hotel in Brussels. And from Brussels, which I took as the centre of our trip, I could travel anywhere on the Belgian railways, because the Belgian railways at that time were government owned, and I could travel anywhere. So we went from Brussels into various towns in Belgium, and we also went to the small village railway station of Zillebeck. Now, Zillebeck, as I remember, is just outside of Ypres, and it's only a few hundred yards. The platform, the station platform, is only a few hundred yards from Hill 60, where I was wounded. And that was the object of me taking the Rover Scouts to this village of Zillebeck. So we arrived at Zillebeck platform, and instead of going off the platform by the ordinary entrance, where the station master porter, only the one man in charge, a little village station, was, I waved to him and he came down, scrutinized our travel permit, and we went off the platform, away from the entrance to the platform, went back down the railway cutting, which I remembered many, many times I had been in that particular spot during the war, down toward Hill 60, where I was wounded. Arrived at the very spot where I was wounded. Where I was wounded, there had been a small bridge across the railway cutting, but during the war it had been demolished, and in 1920 when we visited, the bridge had not been put up again. Well, when we came to the spot where I was wounded, we climbed up into the trenches on Hill 60, out of the railway cutting, which was about 17 or 18 feet deep at that time, a single line railway cutting, climbed up into the field, and lo and behold, when we arrived in the field, there was a trench. Just as the last troops had finished, left it at the end of the war. There was some shouting went on, because it appeared that a woman, the farmer's wife, at the gate was taking £2.50 for anyone to go and visit the battlefield, the trench which the farmer was keeping open for visitors.
Had they ploughed up the rest of the land? Was the rest of the land back to normal or what?
Oh, well, we were only in that one field, you see. We only got in that one field, and it was just a field. And where we climbed out of the railway cutting, there was the trench, our trench, and the German trench had been filled in. So the farmer must have been doing something to level up his land. But it was the British trench, because all the material from the trench was piled up in the field alongside. And the rifles were Lee Enfields, the helmets were British, no Germans, and all the equipment of the whole of the war, mortars and everything else, was all lying in heaps, which the farmer's wife was selling to the visitors after they had visited the trench. I don't think any old fellas bought very much, but we did, went in and out. I remember the trench itself was very, very wet, very, very wet, because it hadn't been looked after. It was just deteriorating. It was a frontline trench. I saw it once that it was a frontline trench. And I answered many, many questions of old fellas, and old fellas prowled about on that trench. We were the only visitors in the field to see anybody else.